Good morning, everyone. We are in John chapter 13 this morning. We have a lot to cover and not much time to cover it in, so we're going to go ahead and jump in and get started. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our out-of-town visitors. It's nice to have you this morning. So if you recall, we picked up in John chapter 13 last time. We didn't get nearly as far as I'd hoped that we would. But we had just begun the account of Jesus washing his disciples' feet. So just kind of by way of review and jumping into this, we recall that John gives us the detail. Before the Passover festival, in verse 1, before the Passover festival, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world to the Father. And we've seen all through John how this hour has been referenced. That Jesus has consistently said, my hour has not yet come, or my time has not yet come. Well, that hour is now. We are at the threshold of the events of the crucifixion. And so if this dinner is actually what we term the Last Supper in the Synoptic Gospels, then we are actually less than 24 hours from Jesus being crucified. Actually, almost less than 12 hours from Jesus being crucified. So this time has come. But the thing is, though, is that all along, Jesus has been very acutely aware of this timetable. He knew when God had planned for him to undergo this crucifixion. He is not unaware of God's plan, and he's not unaware of when it would need to happen. Jesus is in full control. We've said that over and over again. Jesus is in control of events. So the time has come for the Passover lamb. Remember, we discussed how that's how John the Baptist refers to Jesus in John 1. The Passover lamb is now ready to take away the sins of the world at the Passover feast. And we have the detail that he loved them to the end. First of all, that can refer to an amount of time. He loves them from the time that he enters the earth to the time that he leaves it and comes back again. But also the extent of his love. A better way to translate that might be he loved them to the uttermost. And so the extent of that love is seen in this phrase. And I think this idea is going to come up again, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But then we have Judas. Judas playing into the account and performing his role as the betrayer. And we talked last time for a few minutes about, did Satan possess Judas to do this? Was he doing things against his will or without his full knowledge? And I think that we can safely determine, no. Judas is in full control of himself and what he's doing. This is his sin, and he will be held accountable for it. The devil is not coercing him. He's not compelling him or controlling him. Judas is doing this on his own. Okay, so now then we come to the account of Jesus washing his disciples' feet. Let's pick up in verse 3. Jesus knew that the Father had given everything into his hands, that he had come from God, and that he was going back to God. So he got up from supper, laid aside his robe, took a towel, and tied it around himself. Next, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet and to dry them with the towel tied around him. He came to Simon Peter, who asked him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus answered him, what I'm doing you don't understand now, but afterward you will know. You will never wash my feet, ever, Peter said. Jesus replied, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. And Jesus says, one who has bathed doesn't need to wash anything except his feet, but he is completely clean. You are clean, but not all of you, for he knew who would betray him. This is why he said, you are not all clean. Okay, so we'll pause here for just a moment. We mentioned this last time that we get this detail in verse 4. Jesus gets up from the supper, lays aside his robe, and then takes up this towel, wraps this towel around himself. So essentially, Jesus is removing his own garment. He's divesting himself of this garment and then taking on the garment or the attire of a servant. Now, we kind of mentioned this, and I keep coming back to this chapter, but Philippians chapter 2, that Jesus took on the form of a servant. He did not consider it... He gave up his place with God and came down among us and took on the form of a servant. Jesus is literally taking on the form, the appearance of a servant in this particular passage. And again, keep in mind the context from Luke 22. What had the disciples been doing up to this point? They've been arguing over what? Who's the greatest? Who is the greatest? I'm the greatest. No, I'm the greatest. It's like we got Muhammad Ali here. I'm the greatest. No, Jesus says the one who will be great will be the one who serves. And we get more about that particular narrative in the Synoptics. I think particular of Mark 10:45. It's one of my favorite passages from the Gospels. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. So that's what he's doing. So then we get Peter's reaction. And Peter, what can we say about Peter, right? But I mean, honestly, if Jesus had come up to you and started washing your feet, your master, the one you've been following, the one in whom you realize all the authority in heaven and earth has been vested, comes and starts doing slave work, starts washing your feet, I dare say my reaction probably would have been similar. I don't deserve to have you do this to me. So it kind of reminds me of when Jesus comes to John the Baptist to be baptized, right? Remember what John the Baptist said to him in Matthew 3, where John says, I don't need to be baptizing you. You need to be baptizing me. And Jesus says, allow it to be so, for this is the way to fulfill all righteousness. And so that's what Jesus is doing for them. Allow it to be so. But he takes it a step further. First of all, he says, what I'm doing right now, you don't understand, but you're going to. So when he says, afterward you will know, or after these events you will know, what is the afterward referring to? After what? After the crucifixion and resurrection. Exactly right. Okay, so post-resurrection. John's already alluded in the gospel. You think, for instance, chapter 2 and verse 22, that the apostles look back on the things that happened in Jesus' life after the cross, and it brings much more clarity. Now, after he's resurrected, Jesus does teach them and start telling them things about things that happened in his life. But as they think on those things and come to appreciate them more, they get a better understanding. Isn't that the way we are? Aren't we so lucky to have these things after the resurrection so that we understand them and have a greater understanding? Right now, they're flying half blind. But Jesus says, you will understand. And honestly, we see Peter's personal insight. If you read through the book of Acts, especially the early part of the book of Acts, you will see that Peter starts to get it. And then especially as you get into Peter's epistles, 1st and 2nd Peter, Peter gets it, even though he continually stumbles in the gospel accounts. But there's also this other part of it, and this is heavy. Peter says, you will not wash my feet. And he's emphatic about it. You will never, ever wash my feet. And Jesus says, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part with me. That's serious. Now, what that tells me then is, first of all, Jesus' love is unconditional. There is no question. We read it in 13:1. He loved them to the end. It is unconditional. However, Jesus' fellowship is not unconditional. It is conditional. We have to come to Him on His terms in order to have fellowship with Him. And we'll see more about this, especially in chapter 14, because He's going to go into talking about obedience and how that's how people know that we are children of the Father. And then Jesus kind of gives us this curious statement in verse 10. One who has bathed doesn't need to wash anything except his feet, but he's completely clean. What does that mean? Jesus is going to tell his disciples in 15:3 that you are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. So Jesus has cleansed, in a manner of speaking, not fully. He hasn't been sacrificed yet, but Jesus has set apart His disciples by His Word, and they have set themselves apart by listening to it. So, you think about it. A person in this time would have to go to a place of bathing. You don't have a bathroom in your house. You have to go to the bathing place and then come back to your house. Well, as you're walking back from the river or the bathhouse or wherever you're going, what's getting dirty? Your feet are getting dirty, okay? So you've already been cleaned. It's just you got to wash your feet to be completely cleansed. And the idea there is when they came into a household, your feet needed to be cleaned because that was the dirtiest part of you. You were wearing sandals at that time. The streets are muddy or dusty or whatever. And so in order to enter into the master's house, you need to be cleaned. So Jesus is washing their feet. He's telling them to come to Him on His terms so that they can enter the Master's house. So, I always just thought that was a curious statement, but it makes more sense in that context. But He also says, you are clean, but not all of you. So, what's He referencing there? Judas, exactly right. So that's what He says. For He knew, verse 11, who would betray Him. And this is why He said, you're not all clean. So we've got another hint of the presence of a traitor in their midst. And Jesus has already talked about this before, whether they recognize it or not. You remember in John chapter 6 and verse 70, after Peter says, Lord, to whom are we going to go? You have the words of eternal life. And Jesus says, yes, but there is a devil among you. And so the reference there is to Judas, even if they didn't get it at that time. Jesus has true knowledge of the human heart. And so He knows Judas' intentions. There's been no indication in the text so far that Judas has or is going to betray Him. The apostles are certainly unaware of it. Jesus has no direct interaction with Judas that would give Him any clue about this. Jesus knows Judas' heart, so He knows what's coming. Anything else on that particular section? Yes, Mark. Exactly, yes. Yeah. Right. 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 Exactly. And do you think, so what he was saying was, what do you think Judas was thinking? Because Judas is one of the ones getting his feet washed here. What was Judas thinking? Do you think that Jesus is giving Judas an opportunity to keep from doing what he's set out to do? Because I think at various times in this particular occasion, Jesus gives Judas multiple opportunities to turn from what he's about to do. Somebody is going to betray Jesus. Somebody is going to hand Jesus over to the authorities. It doesn't have to be Judas, but it is. So, again, Jesus or Judas acting of his own will and his own intentions, I think that he has the opportunity to turn away from this. Ted. It does talk about, and we will read about this, it does say that it would be a betrayal. So it does seem to indicate that it would be someone either close to him or related to him. I don't think that it has to be Judas, though. That's my personal opinion. If Judas is acting of his own accord, then he has to have free will in this situation. So there's got to be an opportunity for him to turn back from it. Yes, Mark.
Foreknowledge is not predestination.
True. I'll leave it at that. Yes. What's that? He did have money in mind. Yes, we've seen Judas' motivations. He's greedy and he's after those things. But we also see after Judas does it that he's willing to forsake that money. He says, I can't take this, and so he leaves it behind. He just has that change of heart way too late. Okay, so this has taken place, verse 12. When Jesus had washed their feet and put on his robe, he reclined again and said to them, do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord. This is well said, for I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done for you. I assure you, a slave is not greater than his master, and a messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. I'm not speaking about all of you. I know those I have chosen, but the scripture must be fulfilled. The one who eats my bread and has raised his heel against me. So there's the reference there of closeness, and we'll talk about that more in just a minute. I'm telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am he. I assure you, whoever receives anyone I send receives me, and the one who receives me receives him who sent me. Okay, so this whole section then about servants and messengers, that's what the disciples are going to be. And that's what Jesus has been to this point, right? He's been a servant of mankind and a messenger of God's will. So he's telling them then that you are to be like me in this regard, but there's a manner in which you are to do it. So he says, I've given you an example, the foot washing. I've given you an example. And so the emphasis of Jesus' example isn't on the act of foot washing. He's not establishing some sort of command as far as an aspect of worship that we're going to have to participate in. But what he is doing is showing them an act of humility and service. And so just as Jesus, the Son, submits to the will of his Father and exemplifies his love and his providence, Jesus' disciples are to imitate him by deferring to one another and serving all men. And again, I would point you right back to Philippians chapter 2, because that's what Paul talks about there. And he goes on to say, verse 16, a slave is not greater than his master, and a messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. If your master is getting down and doing slave work, do you think that you're in any way better than that? No. You need to imitate him, even if you think that this is a base requirement, that this is something that you're above. And you need to get to the point where you don't think you're above it. Because servants and messengers are chosen to carry out their master's will. They serve him, they represent him, and as Jesus has told them in the synoptics, and as they will see in Acts, a servant shares in his master's fate. If the master's house goes down, the servant goes down with it. Okay, so they're going to share that fate. And Jesus is reminding them, in good times, in bad times, remember your place and remember your responsibility. And this word messenger, this would be a very familiar word for us. Apostolos. What does that sound like? Apostle. Exactly right. One who is sent. And so that's what Jesus says. One who is sent or a messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. And so he says, I'm not speaking about all of you. I know who I've chosen, but the scripture must be fulfilled. The one who eats my bread has raised his heel against me. I want to come back to this when we get down to verse 26 in just a moment. But one thing he says, though, in verse 19, one of the major themes of 13 through 16 is not only Jesus preparing them for the end, but also giving them assurance in that preparation. He doesn't, as he's going to say in verse 4, in chapter 14, let not your heart be troubled. And so that's kind of the beginning of what he says here. I'm telling you this now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am He. How are they going to come to believe that Jesus is who He says He is by the events that are taking place here? What's going to be the sign? What's that? Well, yes, but the fact that Jesus knew it already and told them it was going to happen. So when it does happen, they might reflect back on Jesus' words, and they're obviously not going to do that in the immediate context. They might reflect back on Jesus' words and say, Jesus told us this was going to happen. We shouldn't be surprised by this. Jesus knows that His arrest and His crucifixion are going to shake their faith in Him, and He is preparing them for what's coming. And I think it's interesting. He says that when it does happen, you will believe that, yours might say, I am He, or if you have the NIV, I think it says, I am who I am. Where does that sound familiar from? I am who I am. Exodus 3:14, exactly. So it's not just that they will believe that He is immediately who He says He is, that they will believe that He is God. Look at the vocabulary. Look at the wording that Jesus uses. So that you will believe that I am, ego a me. I'm sorry, I said 3:14. I think that's right, 3:14, Exodus 3:14. And so then he continues this, and he kind of goes in a different vein, but he's pushing this forward. Whoever receives anyone I send receives me, and the one who receives me receives him who sent me. So not only are these things going to happen, Jesus knows they're going to happen, the disciples now have a responsibility to go out. And if the disciples remain steadfast in the coming days, then they're later going to be sent out as messengers of the risen Christ once He comes back. And acceptance of them and acceptance of their message is going to equal acceptance and reception of God. And Jesus has said that multiple times through the book of John. So Jesus calls out and says that there's a betrayer among you. And of course, the disciples are looking at one another. Who is it? Is it me? Who is it? Is it me? And you have to wonder, is Judas sitting there acting like he doesn't know? Or is he just kind of sitting there quietly while they're having this confusion among themselves? I don't know. But presumably John, because he doesn't refer to himself by name, presumably John leans over to Peter and says, hey, ask him who he means. And Jesus says, verse 26, he's the one I give the piece of bread to after I have dipped it. And when he dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas, Simon Iscariot's son. And after Judas ate the piece of bread, Satan entered him. And Jesus told him, what you're doing, do quickly. And then he leaves. So this quote that Jesus gives here, in verse 18, I said we're going to come back to this. The one who eats my bread has raised his heel against me. Comes from Psalm chapter 41, and specifically Psalm 41:9. I think I may have gotten behind on my. There we go. And so the context of that particular psalm is David is reflecting back on two types of individuals. The first part of that psalm refers to an individual who acts with mercy and humility. And he says that the Lord is going to have favor on this person who acts with mercy and humility. Isn't that what Jesus has already called His disciples to do to this point? But then the last part, or I guess it would be the middle part of the psalm because it goes on after this. The last part of this particular section, David laments over a trusted friend who has spoken deceitfully and handed him over to his enemies. So Jesus applying this context then to Judas. And it's a one-to-one correlation here. And so then when Jesus replies to John's question, or to Peter's question, who is it? He says, he's the one I give the piece of bread to. So if they had been thinking about it, if they had been reflecting back on the Psalms, probably should have been a truth bomb in their mind. Maybe think back to what he said. He's the one I give the piece of bread to after I've dipped it. Now, this is interesting, this particular gesture. Because for the master, or the one who is the host of the banquet, to tear off an initial piece, the first piece of the food, and hand it to someone, this is considered a gesture of honor and respect. And so when Jesus breaks off the first part of the bread and dips it and hands it to Judas, he's actually showing him a sign of respect. And yet, this sign of respect is also the indicator of betrayal, of treachery. So it's just a sharp contrast. And again, I think that might be one of the ways in which Jesus is giving Judas an opportunity. And also, think about maybe kind of the scene here. Don't think about the painting of the Last Supper, but think about this. If we assume that John, who is referred to as the disciple whom he loved, is close enough to lean on Jesus' breast, that means John is sitting right next to him. But if Judas is close enough, because this is probably a long table, not a round table, if Judas is close enough to receive this bread, Judas may in fact be sitting on the other side of Jesus. Not Matthew, not Peter, not Andrew. Judas may be sitting at the master's side when Jesus hands him this bread. Speculation, but he does have to be close enough for Jesus to hand this to him. And the indication seems to be that not all the apostles hear Jesus say these things to Judas, especially when he says, go and do what you're going to do quickly, because then they think he's just going to go buy supplies. It seems like they've missed this whole interaction. So this scene, kind of let this soak in and think about the details of this. And so then Judas leaves. And I think this is a very interesting statement at the very end of verse 30. After receiving the piece of bread, he went out immediately, and it was night. Just interesting that John gives us that detail. And it was night. Why do you think he gave us that detail? Have we seen anything about night previously in the gospel? What's that? The light is leaving. Exactly right. The light is leaving. You remember John 9:4. We must do the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no man can work. And so for John to just kind of throw in, or I guess the Holy Spirit through John, to kind of throw in that detail, those are just interesting. So don't overlook any details when John writes about them. I hate to keep moving on, but we've got a lot to go through. When Judas had left, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and will glorify him at once. And so then Jesus goes on to talk to them about, I'm with you a little while longer and you will look for me, and where I go you cannot come. We're going to cover that a little bit more fully as we get into chapter 14. But this one part here about now the Son of Man is glorified. So basically, what's just happened is Jesus has allowed Judas to go and begin the events leading to his death. Judas is going to get the people who are coming to arrest Jesus to carry him away and crucify him. And Jesus has just allowed that to happen. And he says, by this event happening, the Son of Man is glorified. How is that possible? What do you think? He just allowed a traitor to go out to begin the events of his own death. Gruesome death. How is the Son of Man glorified by this? Think about it in terms of what the Son of Man came to do. For instance, maybe what John the Baptist said about him being the Passover lamb. Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man here. Where do we get the idea of the Son of Man from? Comes from Daniel. Daniel 7, exactly right. Comes from Daniel. But what does he say about the Son of Man in Daniel? What's the idea? He's the divine ruler, right? He is the Almighty. He is the one who is given power to rule and is given a dominion that's going to last forever and ever. Jesus is connecting his death to this exaltation. And in so doing, he is glorified. If the death doesn't happen, he can't be exalted to the Father. So these things, remember when Jesus says these things have to take place? That's in Matthew, but these things must take place. In order for him to be exalted to the Father, to reign on high, he must be killed. And so then, the prophesied Son of Man is at the moment of sacrifice, which leads to his glory. And because the sacrificial plan is the Father's, any glory that the Son gets is transferred to the Father, or is given to the Father as well. And so then, not only does man honor the Father by this taking place, but the Father himself will honor the Son for completing his work. Remember, the voice from heaven said, I have glorified my name and I will glorify it again. And the idea is there through Jesus. The Father's going to honor the Son for completing his work, and this glorification is not delayed. It is immediately conveyed through his death, through his resurrection, and through his ascension. Glory is going to happen. But another part of this, then he says, children, I'm with you a little while longer. Not only is this glory going to involve death, it's also inherently going to involve separation. When Jesus comes into his glory, he's not going to be with the disciples at that time. And so for Jesus to accomplish his heavenly task, he must leave the world. And so then he gives them this command, verse 34. And it almost seems like it's kind of thrown in there. But Jesus is giving them ideas of utmost importance here. I give you a new command. Love one another just as I have loved you. You must also love one another. And by this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So, again, we're seeing some conditions placed on Jesus' fellowship. If you don't want love one another, the kind of the contrast of this, then you are not my disciples. And again, John is going to really hammer this idea home in 1 John chapter 3 and 4. But as the disciples follow the Master's footsteps, they're also going to imitate his character and his concern. And if we reflect back to 13:1, we see the extent of Jesus' love. He loved them to the uttermost. And so now he tells them, you have to love each other to that same degree. Because this love is going to do two things. First of all, it's going to bind them together so that they can survive and they can thrive. And that's the only way they get through the book of Acts. It's going to bind them together. But the other thing it's going to do, and it's the result that we see in the book of Acts, the love that they have for one another is going to draw others to them. And that's the emphasis of the last part here. By this, all other people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And the idea is they're going to be drawn to that like a moth to a flame. So they need to be who he is right now to them. And so Peter asked this question then. Peter is obviously in distress. Lord, where are you going? And Peter just jumps right to the heart of the matter. And Jesus, again, he says, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now. And if you recall, hadn't Jesus already said this to somebody previously in the gospel? Who did he say that to? Where I'm going, what's that? He said it to the Pharisees, to the Jews, that's right. He said, where I'm going, you cannot follow. But he adds in something here. What's the part that he adds in at the end of this verse, verse 36? But you will follow later. He didn't say that to the Pharisees. He said, where I'm going, you cannot be. And then you're going to seek me and you're not going to be able to find me. But what Jesus says is, I'm going away, you can't go with me, but I am coming for you. And again, this is going to be more... The chapter 13, 14 chapter break is terrible. It is awful because it just breaks right in the middle of a thought. But this is going to be the emphasis of chapter 14, that he's going to come back for them. But of course, Peter, being Peter, he blurts out, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." And so then we see Jesus give him this this foreknowledge. And he says, "Will you lay down your life for me?" And I think that's kind of the emphasis in his statement. Will you lay down your life for me? Because what's getting ready to happen? Jesus is getting ready to lay his life down for Peter. If Peter dies for Jesus, what happens? Nothing. If Jesus dies for Peter, or if Jesus dies, period, the whole world is saved. Okay, and so Jesus tells him then, a rooster will not crow until you have denied me three times. Peter, you're at a stage of belief, but you're not all the way there yet. You're getting there, but you're not there yet. And so there's going to be a few more hiccups along the way, and we'll see those. So jumping straight into 14, we have like 5 minutes to cover the whole chapter. So maybe just some basic ideas. Again, chapter 14, Jesus is going to deal primarily with the anxiety of the disciples over the announcement of his departure. And he's going to continually get interrupted. Thomas is going to interrupt him by saying, you know, we don't know the way, we don't know where you're going. How do we know the way? Because Jesus had told them, you know the way where I'm going. I'm going to come back and receive you to myself so that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way. And you notice, Jesus doesn't say, you know where I'm going to be. He doesn't say, you know the destination. He says, you know the way. And I think that that's the key to understanding Jesus' great statement here. And this is kind of the last of the great I am statements in John in verse 7. Verse 6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And so the idea here is that they know Jesus. They know his character. They know his teaching. They have been intimately associated with him. And so in knowing him, they know the way to the Father. They see how they are to live, to act, and to operate. And that is the way. But they're not going to be able to reach the destination on their own. They can only make their way down the path. Jesus has to come to them along that path to bring them to the destination, which is the Father. And that's what he says. Notice that the emphasis is not only on making it, you know, to some great reward. He's going to talk about, or he's talked about at the early part of this chapter, did you not know that in my Father's house are many, yours might say, mansions or places? And so when he uses the word mansions, we have this idea of, oh, well, God's going to make us rich. God's going to give us all our own pretty gilded house. To use the words of the song, I've got a mansion over the hilltop. And I'm just going to walk the streets of gold there. And everything's going to be great. No. What is the emphasis on our going to heaven? I think Jesus gives it in verse 4. I will come back and receive you, not to take you to a mansion. I will come back and receive you to myself. Myself. We don't go to Jesus to get mansions or riches or any of those things. That's a gospel that is preached in third world countries to dupe people into following some sort of prosperity gospel. We go to Jesus to get more Jesus. We go to God to get to God. And that's what Jesus says. When I come back to get you, I'm bringing you to me, to the Father. Okay? And so Jesus tells him, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And I think we kind of get some aspects of both Jesus and the Father there. So in the way, Jesus is the means of access to the Father. He's already talking John chapter 10. Remember when he says, I'm the gate for the sheep. Everyone has to come through me to access the Father. That Jesus is the truth. Jesus is the living embodiment of the divine word of the Father. Isn't that John 1:1 summarized right there? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then Jesus is the life. He's the living embodiment of the divine will of the Father for mankind. What was God's will for mankind? John 3:16 and 17. He sent the Son, He sent His only beloved Son, so that whoever believes in Him might have eternal life. God's will for mankind is so that we would come to Him through the Son for eternal life. Jesus says, I am the life. Okay, so each of those is just dropping a bomb there. And so Philip says, Lord, show us the Father. And that's enough for us. That's all we need to know. Just You show us the Father and we will believe. And so then Jesus, he seems distressed here. Have I been among you all this time without you knowing me, Philip? The one who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father's in me? The words that I speak to you, I don't speak of my own. The Father who lives in me does His works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Otherwise, believe because of the works themselves. And so Jesus provides two main pieces of evidence for this assertion of Him being the Father. First of all, His words, which are filled with God's truth. I am the truth. And His works. Jesus has already referenced that to the Pharisees. Believe in the works, if you don't believe in anything else, because they're accomplished with God's power. And both speak to who Jesus is. And they can see the Father at work through Him. So if you've seen Him, you've seen the Father. And so just as a biological son shares traits of his father through DNA, Jesus shares traits of the Father, and they should be able to see that in Him. And Jesus kind of underlines that statement. I assure you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do. Not only believe in my works, but the result of that belief is going to be that you're going to do those works. And he even kind of blows that up and says, He will do even greater works than these. How can we, or how can the disciples, maybe just kind of keep it in context, how is it that the disciples are going to do greater works than Jesus? You ever think about that? What does that mean? Jesus can calm a storm with a word. Jesus can multiply bread from one boy to more than 5,000 people. Jesus has raised Lazarus and others from the dead. How are they going to accomplish greater works than that? What are these works? Okay. And really, even just kind of keep in mind, maybe even just in physical terms, keep in mind the scope of Jesus' ministry. Where has Jesus primarily been based in His ministry on earth? In Galilee and in Jerusalem. So in Palestine. Let's just kind of draw a circle around that. In Palestine. By the end of the book of Acts, where is the gospel? Where has the gospel gone? Everywhere. Everywhere. Throughout the Roman Empire and beyond. So these greater works, it's not that they are greater in terms of the power that Jesus displays. Because, honestly, the works that they're going to do are accomplished through Jesus' power. And that's what He's going to say. They've got to be done in My name, verse 13. Whatever you ask in My name. But they're going to take this seed that Jesus has given them and they're going to grow a giant tree out of it. They're going to grow a whole forest out of it. So when He says you're going to accomplish greater works than these, they've got a big job ahead of them. And if they don't see that, and I think they do, if they don't see that, they're missing something. But despite the fact that He's given them these greater works and that they are vast in scope, He's given them parameters as well. And I think that we need to see kind of the part after this verse as those parameters. First of all, again, when Jesus says, anything that you ask in My name, I will do, He's not giving them a golden ticket. He's not giving them a magic lamp saying, you just rub on this and call My name and I'm going to give you anything you desire. The idea here is that they are doing things in His name or with His authority. Anything that you ask according to My authority, I will grant you, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. And that's the next part of it. When you ask for these things from Me, ask because the Father needs to be glorified, not because you want something. And then they've got to be accomplished, verse 15, in accordance with Jesus' commands. That they've got to be in line with everything that He's already taught them and everything He's already instructed them to do. Now again, I say that this isn't a magic lamp, and I think James kind of elaborates on this for us. Why are there wars and fightings among you? Because you ask of your own desires. You're not asking because you care about the Father's will or the Father's glory. And so that's what Jesus is doing. He's establishing parameters on that. Okay, so we're going to pick up in verse 15 next time and continue on this discourse. Because again, it goes through the next chapter, and then we get to Jesus' prayer for the disciples and for the world. Thank you so much. I know there wasn't very many comments today, but we're moving at this point.